Well, the start date for the Union of Poland and Lithuania is 1385. That's when the first document is signed. And I'll come on a little bit to explain what that document consists of. And it's important to start perhaps with its origins, which lie in two parallel crises which affect two neighbouring states, the Polish Crown and the Grand Duchy of Lithuania. So we should be clear what each of these polities is. So Poland, if we go right back briefly to the beginning, like most European states, it starts out as a tribal polity or power. It converts to Christianity in 966 and becomes a Christian monarchy under its founding Piast dynasty. But it doesn't develop in quite the same way as other early medieval European monarchies, because in 1138, the kingdom falls apart. So one of the kings divides the realm between his sons equally into different portions, and they divide their portions in turn between their sons. And very quickly, what was a single kingdom ends up as this messy patchwork of many different duchies without an overall king or a crown. So for two centuries in the High Middle Ages, the Polish monarchy is just an idea and a powerful memory, but it's lost. And it's only with a living memory of the union between Poland and Lithuania that this starts to be recreated as an entity. So some 50 years before 1385, one of the many Piast dukes, Ladislaus the Elbowhigh, or Władysław Wojciechek in Poland, he pulls together a number of these duchies and makes himself king and makes Kraków his capital. And he starts to reconquer quite a lot of land which had belonged to the Piast monarchy. He doesn't conquer everything which had belonged to Poland at its height in, say, the 10th century. So the Prussian lands are lost, the rich lands of Silesia are lost, but he creates a viable state. The only problem is that these neo-Piasts, these revived Polish kings, they have a territory, but they fail to provide an adequate ruling line. So Ladislaus' son, Casimir the Great, inherits the last Piast king of Poland. He has three wives, a couple of them are bigamous marriages, and he completely fails to produce a male heir. So Casimir, the very last of the Piast monarchs, he dies in 1370, just 15 years before the union. And his death is a really crucial context for all these relations between Poland and Lithuania, which follow in its wake. So we have this very odd period after his death because he's named his heir, his Hungarian kinsman, Louis, King Louis the Great of Hungary, who's an Angevin, a kind of French-derived monarch from the House of Anjou. And Louis spends his time in Hungary. He's an absentee king. There are anti-Hungarian riots in Kraków. And Louis' reign itself has just becomes an extension of his succession crisis because he has no sons. He only has three daughters. So the whole reign is spent with the Poles hand-wringing over what's going to happen next. So in 1384, after Louis' death, the Poles finally crown, they choose one of the daughters and they pick Hedwig, or Jadwiga in Polish. She is only 10 years old. So they have a child queen who's the heiress of the kingdom. And so the Poles have to make a decision in 1384 as to who they're going to marry her to as soon as she comes of legal age and canon law age 12. And they have to marry her immediately. There's no chance of waiting around because when you have an heiress who sort of embodies and has rights to an entire kingdom, anyone who kidnaps her and forces her into marriage becomes king automatically. So there's a credible risk. There are people around, Polish nobles, foreign princes, who through abduction could stage a kind of coup and seize the crown. So they have to act proactively. And the person they turn to is a pagan warrior called Jogaila, who is Grand Duke of Lithuania. So being married to a pagan is a pretty unlikely fate for a princess of French royal blood with a fleur-de-lis on her coat of arms. So why do the Poles do this? It strikes us as quite strange. It's to do with a kind of wider turn to the east that happens in Poland in the reign of Casimir the Great, the last Piast. So Casimir the Great has worked out that he wants to keep expanding and rebuilding the old Polish monarchy. He can't go very far north or west because he's blocked by very powerful Catholic states. But to the east, into the world of Orthodox, the Rus or Ruthenian populations, there is an opening there. So in the 1360s, he turns his army's attention east and he conquers the area around present-day Lviv in western Ukraine, a kingdom called Halych Galicia. So by the end of the Piast reign, the lords of southern Poland are quite excited. They have a bit of Orthodox territory. And when they look east, they see the steppe and they see rich trading cities, they see fertile land and they see a lot of opportunities. And the main obstacle to that is the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, which also wants to expand into the steppe. So the idea is that by partnering with Jogaila and Lithuania, they could perhaps become partners in this enterprise. And it's also the case that Poles like having Lithuania not as an enemy, but as a buffer state. The Poles are aware that all sorts of nasty things can come out of the steppe and surprise you, all sorts of nomadic armies and raiders. And the Grand Duchy of Lithuania as an ally and as a Catholic power would form a very useful buffer between Catholic Poland and everything that lies beyond. So we should ask, who is Jogaila and what is this Grand Duchy of Lithuania, this pagan entity? So Lithuania, of course, also starts as a tribal polity, located pretty much where Lithuania, the nation state, is today on the Baltic coast. But unlike the other tribal polities of early medieval Europe in the north, unlike the Anglo-Saxons or the Vikings or the Poles themselves, the Lithuanians don't convert to Christianity in the 10th or 11th century. They keep their pagan ways. Partly they're protected from Western advances of religion and technology by a huge marshland called the Great Wilderness, an area which remains actually today is still of geopolitical and military significance. So in the 13th century, these pagan Balts start an imperial adventure because they start to conquer a lot of Orthodox land to the south and the east of Lithuania. And these were lands, what we today call Kievan Rus. So Kievan Rus was a great federation of Rus Orthodox duchies, of, you know, huge wealth, wonderful trading cities, which has been seen really ever since as the lodestone of Eastern Orthodox identity and history by East Slavs. So there's this former sort of quasi-imperial entity called Kievan Rus. It's conquered by the Mongols in the 1240s, and then Mongol power itself crumbles over the course of the 14th century. So essentially what the Lithuanians do is they build an empire by moving in as the Mongols start to move out. But it means they end up with a really large state. So this rather small pagan area ends up controlling all of present-day Belarus, most of present-day Ukraine, to far east of the Dniester, and a lot of today's present-day Russian Federation, so land almost all the way up to Moscow. So why does this pagan warlord, who seems to have quite enough to rule already, Jogaila, why on earth would he agree to this union, which comes with the condition of baptism to a Polish princess? So Jogaila is very young in his accession. We think he's one of the youngest Grand Dukes to take power. And he has 12, at least 12 other brothers, and they don't all agree with the fact that he is the chosen successor. So there's a period of immediate civil war, a lot of internal violence, family strife, family murders. So for Jogaila, it seems that being offered a crown and status and resources for the neighbouring kingdom could give him the ballast he needs to assert his rule against his own relatives in Lithuania. But the second, perhaps more pressing reason, or just as pressing reason, is the Teutonic Order. So the Teutonic Knights, I'm sure we'll hear about a little bit more in a moment. The Teutonic Knights have been crusading against Lithuania since the late 13th century, but mostly those have taken the form of raids in forests. And when Jogaila comes to power, the nature of those attacks changes. So the Teutonic Knights start actually trying to take Vilnius, and it looks as if they're trying to extinguish the Lithuanian state itself. So by turning to Poland, Jogaila hopes to get help against both these problems. But it's a huge risk for him. The dynasty are pagan, some of his brothers are Orthodox, and there are no Catholic male relatives in the ruling house. The last Grand Duke to convert to Catholicism was murdered by his relatives. So it's a kind of kill or cure solution to turn to the Polish throne. In terms of how the political establishment is transformed, it's important first to be clear what we mean about the union. So the document that's signed in 1385 is essentially a betrothal document between Hedwig and Jogaila. It's not a marriage, it's not a formal union treaty of any sort. The document itself is on a fairly scrappy piece of paper. It's written in a lot of haste. The handwriting is very bad. There's all sorts of theories about why it's written so quickly. And really from that moment until 1569, for almost the whole Jagiellonian period, the union is a rather informal personal arrangement. So I mean, there are historians who suggest that there's a grand linear march towards a formal union 200 years later. I think most historians in the region would sort of disagree and say it's much more piecemeal. It's often that the two polities often get split. I mean, Jogaila rules Poland, but he has to give rule of the Grand Duchy of Lithuania to his cousin Vytautas. So there's quite a different set of patterns over 200 years of how these two are ruled in tandem. It's only 1569, the end of the period, at the Union of Lublin, but they're fused into one legal entity with one monarchy, one parliament, new institutions, new laws, and that's a whole new world. But the union before 1572 is a very improvised sort of thing.